From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. When Bonnie Raitt started singing the blues, she thought her voice was too high, too clear. Close to 20 years of life on the road has deepened her voice and resulted in a lot of other changes in her life. Bonnie Raitt joins us and previews her forthcoming record on today's Fresh Air. Israeli journalist David Grossman is the author of one of Israel's most controversial books about life on the West Bank. Today, Grossman tells us how he was changed by witnessing the occupation from the perspective of Palestinians. Kevin Whitehead remembers jazz trumpeter Roy Eldridge, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone looks at the international uproar surrounding the Satanic Verses. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In the early 70s, Bonnie Raitt seemed like an unlikely person to popularize the blues. She was white, from a prosperous family, she'd been to Radcliffe College, and her father is John Raitt, who starred on Broadway in The Pajama Game and Carousel. But Bonnie Raitt fell in love with the blues and learned to play slide guitar. She befriended blues singers Fred McDowell and Sippy Wallace and introduced their songs to her audiences. Raitt's repertoire extends beyond the blues. She sings material by contemporary singer-songwriters like Jackson Browne and John Hiatt. She writes her own songs and does rock and roll and ballads. I think it's fair to say her first two albums, Bonnie Raitt and Give It Up, were staples in the record collections of most college students in the early 70s. Even during periods when her record sales have been down, she's maintained an audience devoted to her singing and playing. Bonnie Raitt has a new album scheduled for release in a couple of weeks. It's called Nick of Time, and it's produced by Don Was of the band Was Not Was. From that album, this is Too Soon to Tell.
So now there's somebody new. These dreams I've been dreaming have all it only takes time someday that may be true, but it's too
Bonnie Raitt, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be on the show. I love it.
Okay. I want to ask you a little bit about the new record. I sense this freedom on the record to sing in different styles, do different kinds of songs, blues, ballads, rock songs. Is that something that you always have on records?
It was especially my trademark in the beginning when I was first signed to Warner Brothers back in 71. My first three albums were pretty eclectic that way, and that's the way my musical taste runs, and I think my fans also. There was some criticism at some point when the records didn't sell that possibly that was because it was too eclectic and people couldn't categorize me, which, it's just the way it is. So I stayed with my loyal following and did what I wanted. People are always trying to figure out which direction I'm going to go in next, and I basically just have always played the same mix of rhythm and blues and country and folk and rock and jazz, and I wish radio was open to playing all those different categories also. And the reason this one is like that is because not only am I on a new label who supports that idea of encouraging me to do what I do best, which is probably eclectic stuff, but also the climate of radio, I think, has changed and is coming back around to appreciating roots music and different types of ethnic music. And let's hope there'll be a resurgence of blues and rhythm and blues.
Do you think your voice has changed since the early 70s when you started recording?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, I listen to that stuff and I can barely take it because I always wanted to sound like Etta James. And to me, even though I love Joni Mitchell, I was leaning too much towards that high, sweet kind of sound. And I really wanted to sound like I was, you know, right about like what I am now, which is a broad that's been playing music for 20 years. It's been playing clubs and concerts. And my voice has kind of gotten richer and thicker and, you know, a little huskier, and that's more the way I like to hear it. But I still don't spend a lot of time listening to myself, I'll tell you that.
Did you do things when you were younger to try to deepen your voice?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, just being a rock and roll and blues singer for all these years, you live a lifestyle that's got a lot of late nights and a lot of partying and all that, so I imagine that contributed to it. And I think just a certain amount of maturity, and I like to think that I play and sing better than I did when I was 21, and hopefully when I'm 60, I'll be playing better than now.
You've said that you once took singing lessons to try to protect your voice, but you stopped because you ended up sounding like Vicky Carr. I thought that was really funny.
Well, no, nothing against Vicky Carr either. I just, a lot of those singing teachers want you to sing more legitimate, and you end up doing scales that really are more suited for operatic or Broadway singing, and I kind of left it alone, although I think now as I get older, I'm going to be vocalizing more, even though my band laughs at me when I do it, but just to keep the muscles in the throat from being strained, and so you can sing through a cold. But most of all, I just recommend, being healthy, and I, you know, the things that would wear me down and dissipate me, I don't do anymore. So in general, I'm in a pretty good rejuvenated state, singing-wise and physically.
Your father, John Raitt, had a flourishing Broadway career, best known for his starring role in Pajama Game. Were you self-conscious when you started singing blues that your father was a Broadway star, since the two kinds of music are considered really opposite by a lot of people?
Yeah, it was pretty ironic, but I mean, our generation was growing up with folk music and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and I became a complete blues freak the minute I heard that kind of music, as I'm a big fan of Motown and Stax Vold and soul music. I just think it was a generational thing more than anything, and I certainly don't have my dad's incredible range of and volume of voice. I mean, he still continues to sing all the time. I just saw him in South Pacific last weekend, and you know, Carousel is another show that he created the starring role in, and continues to sing better than ever, and is a constant inspiration to me. But in terms of musical styles, he thought it was kind of odd that his, you know, 16, 17-year-old daughter was singing these kind of double entendre Sippy Wallace songs. So I think he's real proud of me that I've managed to stay in this as long as I have, and I'm proud of him for doing the same.
My guest is singer and guitarist Bonnie Raitt, and she has a new album called Nick of Time that will be out in just a few weeks. I want to play the title song from this album, which is a song that you wrote. And before we hear it, I'd like to ask you if there was something in your life that led to the lyric.
Yeah, I was really inspired to write something that, you know, as an interpreter of other people's material, a lot of times I'm singing whatever I choose to sing is something that I really believe in also, and something I'm going through at the same time. Usually Jackson Browne's a good friend, and I like to sing his songs for that reason. And this particular tune, I just had a bunch of things on my mind that I hadn't heard anybody else say, and I said, well, I guess I'm going to have to get down and write another song, because it doesn't come easily for me. But a friend of mine was, in fact, like the first verse says, going through this situation, having to decide, as a lot of women our age, or my age anyway, are trying to decide whether to have children or whether their career still takes some more time to work on, or whether the two are in conflict with each other. And in this case, the man in her life isn't ready to have children, and she's got to decide because she's almost 40. So the poignancy of that situation was not lost on me, and that's basically, on a long drive in my car one time, it just came to me. And the other verses about my parents getting older and consequently us looking at each other getting older, and just about the choices you make at this point in your life.
Well, this is the song Nick of Time. It's the title track from Bonnie Raitt's new album, and she's featured on vocals and piano.
Yeah.
It's Nick of Time from Bonnie Raitt's new album of the same name, and that album will actually be coming out in just a few weeks. Did you sing any Broadway songs when you were young?
I sure did. I'm a huge fan of Carousel in Oklahoma from hearing my dad do them for so many years, and Pajama Game also, and I did some high school productions of things like Plain and Fancy, which was a kind of an obscure show. And I know all the words to most of the musicals I grew up listening to in my house.
You never still sing that on your records, right?
I never sing. Well, I sing. My dad comes and sings Oklahoma and really usually steals my show a lot of times when he comes out with the band. And he and I sing duets together sometimes. And we sang Blowing Away together once, which was really lovely. And I back him up on guitar. And he's just such an overwhelming singer that I like to shut up or sing harmony.
How did you find the blues and rhythm and blues?
I basically loved soul music, and I also loved folk music. And when I heard that Blues at Newport in 63, when I was 13, which is an album on Vanguard, with Mississippi John Hurt and Brownie McGee, Sonny Terry, Dave Van Ronk, John Lee Hooker, John Hammond, that was the first time I'd actually heard blues, and I just went crazy. I had already been playing Joan Baez songs and Peter, Paul, and Mary songs, as was the whole country at the time in the early 60s, you know, going to peace marches and civil rights rallies and singing Times They Are Changing and all that. And when I heard this other offshoot coming out of the Newport Folk Festival, which was blues, I then tried to get my hands on every record I could and just sat in my room and learned everything I could until I never really planned to do this for a living. And when I was in college back in the East, it became a kind of an oddity that I was playing Robert Johnson songs. So the next thing I knew, I was getting gigs in little clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of fell into it because it was an oddity for a young white girl to be playing that kind of music.
Well, exactly. And I was wondering if you ever had an authenticity crisis, you know, as a white middle class woman who's the daughter of a Broadway star. Did people ever say, "How, you know, do you have the right to sing the blues?"
Hey, I ask the guys I go out with. you know, blues doesn't, you don't have to be white or poor or colored or black or green or whatever. You know, it's just this, that stuff is a constant. I think that blues music needs to be appreciated in its original form. And I had the honor of working with a lot of the great Delta players and Chicago players who did not get recognized while they were alive. And even now, the ones that are still touring should be much bigger stars than they are. So I think there's no problem with people doing each other's music as long as you give credit where credit is due. And basically, whether I'm authentic enough is up to somebody that wants to decide whether they spend money to come and see me. I've been a big fan of this music for a long time, and I play it because I really just have to play it. I love it, and I never asked anybody to like my version of it, and then when they did, I've been lucky enough to get away with it for 20 years.
When you first started singing blues and traveling on the road performing, did you try on the part of blues mama, and were there certain affectations you took on when you were younger that you later gave up, realizing that you didn't have to do that?
Well, I wouldn't call them affectations. I mean, I romanticized rock and roll and blues as a lifestyle, as did many of the other people that went into music, just the way book writers feel like they have to be tortured souls, and they also have a tendency to drink too much, and so do rock and rollers who party too much. And I chose this lifestyle because I really loved it, and I had a great time in my 20s and early 30s staying up late and partying with my friends, and because I got my work done. I mean, it wasn't excessive. It wasn't really driving me. And then recently, since I'm 39 now, in the last couple of years, I decided I want to feel better and look better and sing better. And that kind of lifestyle can be kind of debilitating spiritually and emotionally as well as physically and creatively. So I'm happily sober and healthy, and doesn't seem to affect anything other than the fact that I feel great. You know, I mean, it doesn't change my music. I didn't become a Mooney. I didn't stop being funky or anything. It's just one of the things that my generation of rock and rollers and folk singers and blues singers has learned from losing a lot of our friends from this lifestyle is that at 36 or 37, you've got to cool it. So it's something I'm real happy to have gotten out of my system, and I don't miss it, and I think it's going to allow me to be able to do this for another 30 or 40 years, I hope.
Was there a specific turning point where you realized you wanted to change, you wanted to stop drinking and stop partying that late?
Yeah, you know, you take stock of what you look like and what you feel like one day and just look in the mirror and go, come on, this isn't working, you know. And I also noticed a lot of my friends stopping, and they seemed to be much more at peace and healthier, and they looked better, and they seemed to be having more successful personal lives, and they're writing great songs. And again, they didn't. I was always afraid that I would turn into some kind of fruity, born again kind of a, you know, prissy type of person, and the two personalities wouldn't be able to get together in my head. But it turned out it wasn't the case. And if anything, I feel more frisky than I did when I was 20. You know.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk with you more about your music, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is singer and guitarist and songwriter Bonnie Raitt. She has a new record that's about to come out called Nick of Time, and we'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Singer, guitarist, and songwriter Bonnie Raitt is my guest, and her new album, forthcoming, is called Nick of Time. When I first saw you in the early 70s performing, it struck me that the men and the women in the audience were relating to you really differently, that everybody in the audience was there because they really liked your singing and guitar playing. But the men had all these kind of romantic fantasies about you, whereas the women...
That's a good one. Pardon me while I laugh.
Okay. Whereas the women really saw you as important because there was a certain strength that you seemed to have. You played guitar, bottleneck guitar, you know, slide guitar as well as a regular guitar. And it was, I think, very exciting to see a woman on stage playing an instrument really well and singing and just having this strong sense about her. Did you feel that from audiences, that you meant different things to the men and the women?
Yeah, I do feel that, and I get a lot of letters from people, and I've been told from... I'm really proud to be a role model in some ways for women that are, you know, feeling like they want to be independent and strong and yet keep their vulnerable side and not be too butch or... You know, it's just it's an interesting time to be a woman and to try to come out of your cultural shell, as we did in the feminist movement was growing up the same time we were. And I think that the women that have followed me all these years, and, you know, I'm sure there's younger ones too, there's like daughters of people that were fans of mine from the beginning that are coming up saying that they really derive some inspiration from the songs that I do, and that they play guitar because their mom used to play their records for me. And I know Winona Judd was real influenced. So I'm very proud to have been a role model, and I'm certainly not perfect or a saint, but it's one of the things that means a lot more to me to have lived my life as, you know, politically trying to do the things that I believe in and musically trying to champion the music that I believe in. And I really couldn't care less about commercial success in relation to having the respect of my peers and my fans whose hearts I've touched with what I'm trying to do. And that's all I really cared about. So in that sense, I've had a real successful run.
You've sung a lot of double entendre type of blues songs over the years. And when you started singing them in the early 70s, it was just the time when a lot of women were really discovering feminism and being very firm in the idea that they didn't want to be sexual objects in men's eyes. And I wonder what it was like for you to be discovering these blues songs and sexual double entendre songs at the same time that you were probably also discovering feminism.
Well, if you'll notice, the songs that I do, especially the Sippy Wallace tunes, they are precisely about being, you know, about being sexual and expecting sexual parity and not be, you know, justice is what it's about. You know, you can sing about justice in Central America and you can sing about justice in a relationship. And most of the songs I sing are, if you don't treat me right, get the hell out of here, you know, or you can make me do what you want to do, but you better know how. And, you know, I got a lot of flack for singing Sippy's Women Be Wise song, which has a lyric, "Women be wise, keep your mouth shut, don't advertise your man." Some women these days, they ain't no good, you know. And basically, the tone of the song is that if your old man knows how to do something great to you, don't brag about him because somebody else is going to check him out. And at the time, there was all this talk of sisterhood and nobody should ever, you know, try to steal each other's man. And the fact is that that's been going on since the beginning of time, whether we like it or not. And it was, you know, done with a sense of humor. And it's a little wink and a little nudge and a sexual battleground or the playground, however you choose to look at it, is something that should be you should sing about from all the different angles of it. And I caught a little flack from gay women and feminist women in the beginning, but it's all contained in my estimation of myself is that I'm not going to take any undue grief from anybody, especially not anymore. And, you try to be as playful and as strong at the same time. And all these songs that I sing, if you take them as a whole, they project a pretty strong yet vulnerable impression. And that's the one I think is the one I feel, and I think a lot of women do also. But it was awkward at the time. But I think the double entendre part of it is just a celebration of sexuality. Nothing wrong with that.
I want to play one of those double entendre songs, and this is from the second album that you made, from Give It Up. And this is a Sippy Walla song called Gotta Know How. That's Bonnie Raitt, her second album from, what is it, around 1973?
72.
Well,
it takes me back. Well, I have to sit here with a big grin on my face, listening to that and remembering all the things that were going on at the time. That's a great thing about being able to do this over a long period of time, is each record is like a time capsule for me of the musicians I played with and what was going on.
The song that we just heard was written by Sippy Wallace, who you had befriended, and you sang a lot of her songs and recorded a record with her, and you were really responsible for bringing her into prominence again. Was she something of a role model for you? Was it important for you to find a woman who had sung the blues?
Yeah, Sippy's songs were different than some of the other classic blues songs of the period, because she was not a victim. I mean, her songs were really strong, and she was, asking the guys that she was singing to treat her right. And it basically wasn't, beat me up and I'll still love you kind of a thing. And I just liked her attitude, and I liked her humor, and I liked her sassiness, and had no idea she was still alive when I recorded those songs. And when I found out she was alive and living in Detroit, when they asked me to play the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival back in 72, I asked her to come out and meet me, and asked her if she would sing a song. And initially she only would do a gospel song, she said, because like a lot of older blues people, there's a schism between singing the blues, which is the devil's music in some people's minds, and then singing gospel music as you get older and you're trying to make peace with God for all the stuff you did when you were younger. And she got in the trailer and was just sort of, I started singing Women Be Wise, and my clarinetist was playing, and she started rocking back and forth and said, well, maybe I could just do one or two, So it ended up being the beginning of a new career for her, and a very close friendship until she passed away a couple of years ago. I miss her a lot and sing songs and feel her presence all the time when I sing her stuff.
Mm-hmm. Where do you find songs now? Some of them you write yourself, some of them are older songs, but a lot of them are from your contemporaries. Are most of the songwriters whose songs you sing friends of yours?
Yeah, I listen to the work part of what I do, aside from packing and unpacking and changing cities every day, is listening to hundreds of tapes, unsolicited or solicited, and calling up lots of people and finding out who's got what songs. And I basically find somebody like Jerry Williams, whose songs I've recorded, two on this album and several on the other albums I've done. A woman from San Francisco named Bonnie Hayes, who's got two excellent albums out that are as hard to find as mine are. And I love her writing, and I tend to stick with people. Once I find them, I tend to find a certain compatibility, and musically and lyrically, and then I like to stay with them for a while. That's why I've done quite a few Eric Cass songs and Jackson Brown songs, and it's fun. I'm basically an interpreter. I am a big fan of other people's music, and when I find a song that really touches me, I usually find myself sitting down at the piano or the guitar and learning it in my key and putting my slant on it, and then if it really fits right and I think I can add something new to it, I record it.
You sing a lot of ballads, and it really always sounds like you're putting your heart and soul into it when you're singing a song about heartbreak. And I guess I'm wondering if it's exhausting to put yourself through that. You seem to really get emotionally involved in those songs.
Yeah, I'll tell you, if I did ballads all the time, I would probably slip my wrist at the end of the show. But that's why, that's why you mix it up a little bit. I don't think the audience wants to hear too many sad songs in a row. I've accidentally put a string of things together that have made me end up not being able to go on for a minute and have to take a little break. There's certain songs like River of Tears, which is an Eric Cass song from the Green Light album that I sang with Richard Manuel from the band. And at night, when I sing it, I dedicate it to Lowell George and Paul Butterfield and Richard and Jesse Ed Davis and Roy Buchanan and a bunch of friends of mine that I've lost from rock and roll living. And sometimes if I sing that and stay too long at the fair and song about the Midway in a row, I'm done myself in. So that's when it's time to reel out something funky, you know, kick it up a little bit. And then, you know, I think that's why people play music. They get inspired both ways, mm-hmm. to go on and to have their heart broken again.
Bonnie Raitt is my guest, and we only have about a minute left. So I just want to ask you about being on the road. A song that you wrote for your new album is called The Road's My Middle Name. Is it going to be hard for you staying on the road, having given up some of the alcohol and late nights and things that you were talking about before? It seems that the road leads to that so easily.
Well, I've been doing it for a couple of years now, and it's, if anything, it just makes it really fun for me to be able to have a bunch of extra hours and do different things. Like I said, I enjoyed it while I was doing it. I'm enjoying not doing it. I had enough. I'm looking forward to doing this like Sippy. I mean, Sippy was 88 when she died. My dad's 72 now and going strong. And one of the great things about not being a sex goddess is that people listen to what I sing and not what I look, and don't care so much what I look like. So I guess I'll be able to, more gracefully than others, being an instrumentalist and an interpreter of other people's material, and blues and jazz being accepted when you're 66 years old or whatever, a little bit more easily than rock and roll. It'll be interesting to see how many of us survive, and it isn't difficult at all. It's just, it feels great. I really love my job, and I feel very lucky to be able to keep doing it.
Bonnie Raitt, thanks so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Bonnie Raitt's new album, Nick of Time, will be released in a few weeks on Capitol Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, writer V.S. Naipaul joins us. His novels and books of nonfiction are informed by his own sense of rootlessness and estrangement. His parents were from India. He grew up in Trinidad, and he now lives in England. I hope you can join us. Here's more from Bonnie Raitt's new album. This is a John Hiatt song called Thing Called Love.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Israeli journalist David Grossman returned from the West Bank, he was left with the feeling that the occupation had terrible consequences for both Palestinians and Israelis. Grossman's book about his time on the West Bank, The Yellow Wind, became one of the most controversial books in Israel's history. Coming up, Grossman updates the story. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead looks back on the life and the influence of the late trumpeter Roy Eldridge. And Laurie Stone examines the political and literary world's reaction to the satanic verses. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. President Bush today decided not to call for a review panel that would have led to a 60-day delay in the expected strike by the machinist union at Eastern Airlines. The president rejected a recommendation by the National Mediation Board to intervene in the dispute. Following the administration's announcement, the Airline Pilots Association called for a nationwide work-to-rule slowdown by its members at airlines other than Eastern. The call defies a threat by the Bush administration to ask Congress to ban secondary labor actions. The Pilots Association also called on Eastern pilots to honor the machinist picket lines. We get more from NPR's Barbara Mantell.
Henry Duffy, the head of the Airline Pilots Association, announced that the union was advising its Eastern pilots to honor a machinist strike if one occurs and not to cross picket lines at Eastern. Duffy also said that he believed safety in the skies might be in jeopardy during a strike, although he did not say why. But he said because of his safety concern, he is advising all 41,000 union pilots at every airline to strictly adhere to federal safety procedures. He is advising pilots, Duffy said, not to take allowable safety shortcuts, but to go strictly by the book starting next Tuesday.
Unfortunately, these additional procedures will cause delays. If the price of maintaining safety is inconvenience, it is a price worth paying.
Duffy apologized for the delays in advance to the flying public. I'm Barbara Mantell in New York.
Former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane today drew a suspended sentence for lying to Congress about the Iran-Contra affair. He was also ordered to pay a fine of $20,000, and he will have to perform 200 hours of community service. Before his sentencing, McFarlane told the judge he regretted contributing to the turmoil surrounding the Iran-Contra case. The State Department has moved a step closer to reconsidering its talks with a Palestine Liberation Organization. Reacting to three recent Palestinian raids on Israeli positions in southern Lebanon, the department is questioning PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat's renunciation of terrorism. Barry Schwide has more.
Spokesman Charles Redman, reading from a carefully drafted statement, said even when the U.S. opened talks with the PLO last December, it knew certain PLO factions, especially those controlled by Syria, opposed Arafat's more positive stance toward Israel. But, Redman said, the question now is whether Arafat can or wants to control those factions. The statement even questioned Arafat's commitment itself. Redman said U.S. Ambassador Robert Pelletreau would make these points to PLO officials when they hold their next meeting in Tunisia. Clearly, the Bush administration is reluctant to suspend the two-and-a-half-month-old dialogue. It is under pressure from European allies, the Soviet Union, and Arab governments to deal with the PLO. But if the State Department concludes the PLO is engaged in terrorism, the department may have no choice but to suspend the talks. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Democratic Senator Dennis DeConcini today announced his opposition to the nomination of John Tower to be Secretary of Defense. The Arizona senator had been considered one of a handful of Democratic senators likely to support Tower's nomination. DeConcini said senators must not have reservations and doubts about Tower and that the Senate must not take a chance on the nominee. Meanwhile, President Bush made a trip to the Pentagon today for a security briefing with Tower, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman William Crowell, and National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft. A Senate vote on Tower's confirmation is expected next week. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 8 points to close at 2274.71. Advances led declines 3-2 on volume of 152 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 14 cents. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz trumpeter Roy Eldridge was 78 when he died on February 26th. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Eldridge was a fiery and fiercely competitive soloist who brought a new level of facility and excitement to his instrument. He played stratospheric high notes throughout his solos instead of using them for dramatic finales the way Louis Armstrong did. Kevin has this appreciation of Eldridge. Thank you.
Larry Eldridge became a major force in the development of jazz trumpet, partly because he didn't know any better. As a teenager in the 1920s, he was not an admirer of the great Louis Armstrong. Instead, he patterned his trumpet style on the saxophone work of Coleman Hawkins, seemingly oblivious to the fact that saxophone is much easier to play than trumpet. Eldridge got his first job as a professional trumpeter playing, note for note, Hawkins' solo on Fletcher Henderson's Stampede. Eldridge never recorded his version, but picture a 16-year-old kid playing this sax solo on trumpet in 1927, and you'll get an idea of his raw talent and his lack of realism. When Roy Eldridge finally heard Armstrong in person in 1932, he became a fan like everyone else. Eldridge figured that if he could combine the speed and daring he had already with Armstrong's genius for constructing a solo, he'd be onto something. He was right. He got his first big break with Fletcher Henderson, with whom he recorded this trumpet and vocal feature in 1936.
Mary had a little lamb, but he disappeared at night. Mary couldn't find a lamb, oh, you better be careful, baby.
In 1941, Roy Eldridge became featured soloist with, and the only black member of, drummer Gene Krupa's big band. There he played spectacular solos and engaged in some good-natured musical jive. But Eldridge did his best work in the late 30s and the 1940s with small groups. His light sound and fleet conception won the admiration of the emerging bop trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie. Through Gillespie, he influenced virtually every jazz trumpeter to follow. On a 1944 recording with his early idol Coleman Hawkins, Eldridge's typically modern approach to rhythm, harmony, and line made him sound a bit like a bopper himself. Eldridge wasn't enamored of every new development in jazz. He was a widely quoted critic of avant-gardist Ornette Coleman. But in 1960, as a gesture of solidarity with some younger rebels, he recorded with bassist Charles Mingus and saxophonist Eric Dolphy. Thank you. Roy Eldridge continued to work and record until he retired in 1980. His impact on the jazz trumpet is hard to overestimate, but his legacy extends to all jazz musicians, not just trumpeters. By example, he reminded them that they needn't draw inspiration only from players of the same instrument they themselves play, and needn't be restricted to what's supposed to be possible on their horns. Roy Eldridge proved that in jazz, even the impossible is possible.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Fresh Air. Israeli novelist and journalist David Grossman describes himself as belonging to the generation that celebrated its bar mitzvah during the Six-Day War. In the 1980s, Grossman felt he had to confront the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. His controversial book, The Yellow Wind, is based on 3 months he spent there in early 1987. In The Yellow Wind, he wrote, "I could not understand how an entire nation like mine, an enlightened nation by all accounts, is able to train itself to live as a conqueror without making its own life wretched." Grossman's 1987 trip was his first trip to the West Bank. I asked him why he never went before.
I think so many Israelis, including me, are very reluctant to go there, to the territories. It's not a very pleasant reality to watch. It's something very difficult even to confront Palestinians on the streets. It was also very difficult for them. You know, we and the Palestinians, we both developed a kind of a hollow look in order not to see each other, because in a way I think we together were kind of partners in a very debatable bargain. I mean, I don't think that this occupation could last for 21 years unless we and the Palestinians were very cooperative about taking this heavy burden of the distorted situation together.
You've said that Israel has had to learn to live like conquerors. Has that gotten even worse since the uprising?
Everything is much more extremist now since the uprising. Everything is very, very clear and sharp. I think, on one hand, you can say that there are some good aspects in the uprising. I'm not talking, about, of course, about the violent sides of the uprising, which should be denounced. But I think that for the first time since 21 years, we Israelis, we had to open our eyes. It was like we ran a kind of a business with the Palestinians. The occupation turned to be almost an economic business. The immoral surrendered to the amoral. And suddenly now we have an enemy. We have someone. We have a very clear entity in front of us. They started to be men and women. I will tell you, I sat the other day with a family that I know, and we watched television, and they were quite right-wing people. Mm-hmm. And suddenly there was a kind of a demonstration of Arab women, and that woman told me, look at their women. They are so attractive. I never felt that they are so attractive. Suddenly they became, you know, attractive men, women, human beings. You know, we are so similar to each other in our vitality, in our pragmatic Mediterranean approach to life, in the way that we are carried away by words, in our distorted self-destruction instinct, so many things. And I really think that once there will be peace, it will be so easy to us to live together with those people.
Have you been back to the West Bank since the uprising?
I was 3 times. I prefer not to go there. I think it is a state of war now, and I think that I don't like to be there.
Do you feel that the kinds of communication that you had in earlier 1987 when you were doing the research for your book, couldn't happen now, that there'd be too much rage for you to really talk to Palestinians if you were there?
I think that right now, in the last weeks, there is a turn in the situation. Because until a month or 2 months ago, there was nothing to talk about with Palestinians. They were, first of all, they were very drunk with their new power. Right now, I think they come to understand that the solution will be a kind of a compromise and it will be a partial solution. And I really think that within very few months, we shall be able to talk together on a very realistic level, we and them.
What makes you feel that way?
It's inevitable. It is just inevitable. I see the waves in the public opinion in Israel. You know that last week there was a kind of a political poll in Israel, and 54% of the population were in favor of negotiation with the PLO. It is something that was unthinkable of half a year ago, and it's not easy for me either to say these words. I know I don't think we have good reasons to trust the Palestinians or the Arabs, and Israel should be very strong and all the time on the alert. But I think that if we don't do that, we shall be in greater danger.
A novel that you wrote in 1986 has just been translated into English and published in the United States. It's called See Under Love. I'm interested in if you've remained interested in writing fiction, given how describing the drama of real life has so preoccupied you.
I'm a fiction writer. First of all, this writing of The Yellow Wind was a kind of an adventure for me. But I am a fiction writer. I'm also a playwright. This is what fascinates me the most. There is nothing that can equal, even not the diversity and the interest of the life in Israel. Nothing can catch me more than, you know, creating a private world of my own, which I can describe with my own words. I mean, words that no one else already used and therefore abused. That's wonderful writing.
The new novel is about a boy's obsession with understanding what happened in the Holocaust, and it's very frightening to him because it affected people from his family, but he was too young to have witnessed it himself. And I was wondering if you had a similar terror when you were growing up. You grew up in Israel after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
You were born in 1954.
Uh-huh. And I'm not a son of survivors, though everyone thinks so because of this book. But I think we are all survivors, not only in Israel. I think everywhere in this world after the Holocaust, we have something new in our genes. And yes, this is a story about Momik. He's a 9-year-old child. He's son of survivors, but they never talk to him about the Holocaust. They never say Poland. They would say over there instead, because even the name Poland is like a spell that they are afraid of. And then someday he hears Bella, the owner of the grocery store, also a survivor. She mentions the Nazi beast. That's how Nazism was referred to in those days, and also now in Israel, the Nazi beast. And Momik is sure that she means a kind of extinct monster or dinosaur that used to rule in over there and frighten the people there. And he asks her, what was the Nazi beast? But she refused to tell him, and she said there are some things, thank God that 9 years old shouldn't know yet. But Momik decided that he must find such a beast, and he wanted to tame it and to change its ways in order that it will stop torturing all the people around him. And so in the cellar of his parents in the 50s, Momik is raising the Nazi beast.
How does the story of the main character Momik relate to your own personal story?
As I said, I'm not son of survivors, but I think I can feel this mentality of survival that exists very vividly in my life and in Israel. And this story is a story of someone that has a constant worrying in himself between just to be a survivor, just to go on and survive, and on the other hand, to live full life, meaningful life, life full of new experiences, to explore everything he can do. And this is the war I know from myself and from Israel. That's why I'm writing. You know, I write because I fight. This is my way of fighting my fears and my inherited tendency to suspect, to mistrust people, not to expect too much of this life. I write because I want to be here. You know, Kafka said, books aren't there to make us happy or to entertain us. Books are there to be like an ache to the frozen sea in our souls. And I write about everything that is turning to a kind of frozen sea within my soul. I want to break the ice. That's why I wrote The Yellow Wind, for example, because I felt that everything to do with Arabs is turning into a kind of a frozen sea within me. I felt the exact place in my body where I forged my fears to hatred. And I didn't want that. I didn't want to obliterate myself that way.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
David Grossman is the author of The Yellow Wind. His novel, Sea Under Love, has just been published in English by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us with a look at what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's on the show?
Well, more on John Tower. The debate in the U.S. Senate goes on. Also, more on Salman Rushdie. Yesterday, the foreign secretary in Great Britain issued a statement that seemed to distance the government and the cabinet from Rushdie. We'll hear about that and talk with Tariq Ali, filmmaker, writer, famous 60s student activist in Britain, a man who's also born and raised in Pakistan, to hear what he has to say about the Rushdie affair. We'll also be talking with Dr. Clifford Stoll, who is an astronomer, who out in Berkeley noticed somebody hacking in his computer one day and is now the super sleuth who evidently helped crack a KGB computer hacker ring in West Germany.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The controversy surrounding the publication of Salman Rushdie's novel, The Satanic Verses, is still reverberating throughout the literary, political, and religious worlds. Critic at large Laurie Stone has been monitoring the unfolding actions and reactions and has these thoughts.
It is the nightmare come true of every novelist who writes autobiographically. They will kill me if I muck with the family myths. In Salman Rushdie's case, the family claiming defamation is the body of Muslim believers. Rushdie doesn't consider the Satanic Verses blasphemous. In a statement published in the March 2nd New York Review of Books, he presents a brief history of Islamic views of Muhammad. He says that the prophet, unlike Jesus, isn't divine and therefore might reasonably be subject to a plethora of human emotions. That some believers are offended by this view isn't disputable. The question is, what is the just way to protest offensive writing? It isn't just to threaten the life of a writer or to burn books or threaten publishers and booksellers. Those are intolerable breaches of free speech. You'd think that all citizens in countries that call themselves democracies would be outraged by the price put on Rushdie's head, but it hasn't been the case. Before February 22nd, when writers in New York and other cities militantly defended Rushdie, publishers and government institutions were waffling and apologizing to beat the band. Rushdie's French and German publishers put a hold on publications. Revenue Canada, a government customs and taxation agency, placed a temporary ban on imports of the novel. Several bookstore chains here stopped selling Satanic Verses. They could have offered fearful workers time off. These chains have since resumed selling the book, but as recently as a few days ago, Viking Penguin, Rushdie's British publisher, said that if the execution order were revoked, the company would consider suspending publication of the paperback version. The Soviet Union, currently courting diplomatic relations with Iran, hasn't made a peep of protest, nor have Soviet writing organizations. How to explain this tolerance of Khomeini's tactics when his taking of hostages and other acts of terrorism are reviled? An American president, Carter, lost an election because he wasn't deemed sufficiently tough in facing down the Ayatollah. The pitiful truth is that many people here and abroad aren't dismayed by Khomeini's assault on secularism and free speech. In the weeks following the death order, the offended coterie has expanded to include other religious conservatives. Suddenly, cultural imperialists are making common cause with the Third World. Cardinal O'Connor has advised Christians to shun the satanic verses. It wouldn't be surprising if George Bush were brushing up on the Koran. Our Bush, who has condemned terrorism but has made no brief for free speech. Rushdie's novel shows that divided impulses, not received laws, motivate human beings. Irony and ambivalence are his crimes against orthodoxy, which always boils down to the conviction that God ordains the privileged to rule the weak. Just when you thought art, having for so long cross-dressed as consumer merchandise, had no teeth to bite anyone, a book comes along that's considered dangerous for the right reasons. This point will, hopefully, not be underlined with Rushdie's death.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Mandy Patinkin won a Tony Award for his portrayal of Che Guevara in Evita. He also starred in Stephen Sondheim's Sunday in the Park with George and in the movies Yentl and The Princess Bride. Next time, we talk with Mandy Patinkin about his acting career and his new record. It's his first. Rock historian Ed Ward surveys the women rockabilly singers who were trying to make it big at the same time as Elvis Presley. And television critic David Bianculli previews Anything But Love. It's a new sitcom starring Jamie Lee Curtis and Richard Lewis. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.